while Siegfried Winkels is without question the one on the scientific side of this consideration, Don Behringer is a musician. So he is now speaking about the art, I guess. And he studied music for 4 years at the University of Arizona and the University of Illinois. And then he played trumpet in the president's own U.S. Marine Band in the years 65 until 69. Unfortunately, a motorcycle accident changed his life, but finally he reassigned to the Marine Band recording lab. And there he served as a recording engineer for the Marine Band for 22 years. That's a long time. And now he revisited recording concepts and practices, and he thinks they might eventually be leading to a resumption of experimental recording. So please go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Jürg. Thank you. Good afternoon to you. There's a famous American humorist that from around the early 20th century that got his fame by making his observations on life in America, and he was beloved for this by everyone. And when he got done with making his observations, he would often add this very famous caveat. He would say, "Now folks, all I know is what I read in the newspaper." Which was a double-edged because the newspapers at that time were especially and notoriously unreliable. So everyone got the joke when Will Rogers told them. But it seems to be that we recording engineers have a similar constraint because all we know is what we hear from our live speakers. And what I was able to hear from them greatly changed with the Dipole loudspeakers that were just described in part one. It was 10 years after retirement as a recording engineer, sitting in my living room, I recognized the qualities of a monitor loudspeaker for the first time. How's this for timing? 10 years after retirement, and now, there it is. As a result, my previous life began to involuntarily return, and gradually, and the unanswered questions were still there. What would it be like to use accurate monitors in the recording process? Would they be as important as logic suggests? Well, why not go through all my classical CDs and see what there is to hear now? And I did so. And indeed, there were some areas of interest and consequence. Learning from the monitors. First of all, there were fewer distractions from the music that I noted. Now, this is a little bit like the dog that doesn't bark getting more attention than the dog that does bark. And I would later learn that this was my introduction to the absence of audio artifacts. The stereo canvas was larger than heard before. And it was the context of the recording venue that was the most convincing component of this. The limits of coincident, near coincident, and space microphone techniques were revealed. Now, the main characteristics of these two techniques, coherence and spaciousness, have been heard before by engineers almost from the beginning, using every kind of loudspeaker. That's not a secret at all. But now, it was the limits that were clear. Again, it's kind of like attention is drawn to something that doesn't happen. This keeps recurring in this experience I had. Now, I had to choose early on coherence or spaciousness. It's a fundamental decision all recording engineers have to come to. And so I chose coherence over spaciousness, and I was right. But the thing is, anyone who chose spaciousness was also right. We were all correct. We were all partially correct. Because what we were doing was we were all identifying two fundamental requirements of auditory recognition. We need both of them, but we could only choose one. the two microphones, however arrayed, cannot produce a complete recording. They are all audible shortcuts. All recordings sounded artificial and incomplete to varying degrees. Now, I did not mean to say that all were undistinguished, not at all. They ranged from enchanting to unrewarding and everywhere in between. But my own favorites, I think, were those that satisfied the longest. And the missing quality was realism. And the question is, can realism then be recorded and reproduced? How? Well, the plan for reality-based recording, first of all, must begin with choosing the perspective. This is not a difficult choice for me at all. That's where the audience sits, by the thousands. They pay to sit there every night. It's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. And also I've noticed throughout my career that usually young, idealistic conductors would start a passage in rehearsal, a quick run out to the middle of the auditorium to see what really is happening. They know where reality is, and it's not available at the podium. So it's a simple question. We start with the audience perspective. The mic technique should combine spaciousness and coherence. Now, I think 50 years of competition between these two qualities amounts to historical proof that we need and want both of them. But how to combine them? Well, here, I think an obvious division of labor suggests itself. First of all, a near coincident pair to coherently pick up the initial source from the ensemble. This is where we depend upon coherence. This is where it pays off. This is where it matters. We need coherence at that stage. Then, a pair of spaced omnis to the rear to pick up the response of the venue, providing the necessary context for the initial source. So, each pair is optimized for two quite different sonic scenes. Here's a diagram of it. You can see there's a 5 meter distance from the front cardioids to the rear omnis, and the rear omnis are spaced 4.5 meters. The numbers on the inset there aren't necessarily up to date. If the 17 centimeter microphone separation, the way it looks now, the 17 centimeter separation were kept, then I would change it from 90 to 100 degrees. But if I kept the 90 degrees, then I would change the separation to 20 centimeters. But we're still learning this. And the rest of the recording plan for experimental work is, first of all, location of the front pair will be determined by ear. Now, by this I mean I start at the front near the ensemble and walk backwards into the auditorium until I hear a fair, balanced, representative sound to the whole procedure there. That's where the front mic stand goes. There would be more on this a little later. All microphones will be placed at ear height. This will remove a variable during evaluation. The cardioids will be aimed horizontally, the omnis vertically, and they will be recorded on 4 channels while listening to the live performance for later mixing. So, I purchased some Shep's microphones and accessories, an Everroll R4 that will do the 4-channel recording, and Adobe Audition 1.5 software to do the mixing. Mic stands, carrying bags. I'm back in the business again. Now it's time for some experimental recording. I did not plan on it. I'm very unwilling. Well, here's a picture of one of the venues I used, which is Schlesinger Hall. But the inset I show, because I'm a little proud of this, I have to demonstrate that I found that by adding a second shock mount, the Shure A53M, that I could greatly reduce stand sourced noise. So I had to show them. Now, here are the results from the first 2 sessions. First of all, the 2 microphone pairs do combine constructively. Well, that's the first thing to learn. and I'm glad of that. Now, the live experience was, in all essentials, replicated in my living room. It was difficult to note differences. It was difficult to make the attempt to note the differences. It seemed like inappropriate behavior. I found that interesting. Well, I think an important explanation of this improbable result is that live music is predominantly and very uniquely a forward biased acoustic event for the audience. The performers are in front of us, and they occupy our full attention. And if that part is captured correctly, then the most important work is done. You've done basically everything. And that, I think, explains my reaction in my living room. You're hearing everything you heard there. You know, what's left to hear? You don't notice what isn't there. You're concentrated on what is there, just as you were during the live performance. The absence of a recording engineer was noticeable. And very welcome. I mean, if you have two loudspeakers that can disappear, doesn't it make sense that if you could only get the recording engineer to disappear as well, now you've got something. The stereo seat was of reduced importance. This was also a welcome result. I've always associated a stereo seat with artificiality. I mean, no sense such restriction applies to live music. So when you get a stereo seat, you have to sit here. Well, you know right away, nothing real is going to happen. It's going to be artificial. So I was happy for that. The stereo format contains a surprising capacity that had clearly been unexploited. And now it is a complete and legitimate sound field format as far as I'm concerned. And realism can be recorded and reproduced. Well, all right, it's sort of worked fine, but what can be improved? Well, sure, something has to be improved, and so there, yes, there were some refinements in order. First of all, the microphone location. We started off with the omnidirectional mics located 11 meters behind the front pair and separated 11 meters so that they were decorrelated from each other and from the front pair down to 30 hertz. Well, it turns out that the rear omnis have to be in the same neighborhood as the front pair. So by a few experiments, I moved them up and down to 5 meters. It's okay. Now I do spacing experiments with them, and I ran experiments at 3, 4.5, and 6 meter spacing. I found 4.5 meter spacing is just about right. And the interesting part of the location of the front pair, locating by ear, indeed works. The story is that at Schlesinger Auditorium, which has no center aisle, so it makes it very difficult to walk back and forward, find your favorite place there. And I showed up a little late on this particular session and simply measured half the distance of the stage and used that distance to position the front microphone pair. And by the way, in all of these sessions, that's basically where this microphone stand is going to wind up. It'll be in that neighborhood, half the stage width. So I set it up between aisles, rows 7 and 8, sat down to listen. They start the rehearsal, and I'm like, God, this is a terrible sound, very, very unpleasant sound. I don't want to sit here listening to this. I'm not going to enjoy sitting at home listening to this. So I wandered around, got up, wandered around, and found that the row in back of me, 80 centimeters in back of me, sounded surprisingly better. Now, this isn't supposed to happen in halls, in acoustics. I mean, normally it's a matter of, the center mic stand is a matter of meters, but not centimeters. But that's what my ear told me. Next opportunity, I'll pull the mic stand back one row. In mixing in my living room, you can hear the change just as clearly as you could there. Siegfried could hear it 3,000 miles away in his living room. There's no problem hearing it at all. So the lesson of this is trust your ears. Now, I know that it is said that our ears and microphones do not hear the same way. Well, of course they don't, but forget about that. For these purposes, it's not a problem. When it comes to determining what constitutes hostile audio territory, these mics and your ears have no problem agreeing on what that is. There's a very, very high degree of correlation between the, where that front mic stand goes and where your ears say it should go and what you hear for the results after mixing. Very high degree of correlation. Trust the ears. You won't go wrong. Now, on the front pair configuration, there were many experiments carried out here. The first two sessions, I used the MK41 supercardioids. They did not mix well. It was difficult to find a good mix, and I attributed this to the rear lobes, the supercardioids, and so at the next opportunity, I'll try the ORTF. Very good improvement, very good improvement. So now the question arises, well, is there another combination of spacing and angle that would work better? And at this point, Siegfried got very interested, and he wanted to know how these various angles and spacings mapped into front loudspeakers. And we could bring a little order to what we were going to try next, rather than just grabbing things out of the air. And so he, using the work of Michael Williams, came up with this chart that was very helpful. And it shows, breaks things down into a ratio of mono to stereo. And so you'll see the center axis there, it depicts 17 centimeters separation. And this is the 70 degree angle between capsules. This is the 90 degree, and this is the 110 degree line. The blue dot represents the performance of the ORTF combination, which is roughly 50-50% mono stereo. So we chose the 70-20, the red dot,
French,
and I tested that at the cathedral at the next opportunity. I thought that was better than the ORTF. Well, then let's go whole hog. Let's try, if that is that influential, how influential is it? So let's go all the way down here and go for broke. 60 degrees, 17 centimeters. I tried that at Schlesinger Hall, the very small concert hall. Pleasant sound, but the stage width was too narrow. It just wasn't as you heard it there. It was obviously too narrow. So I went back and had 70, 80, and 90 degree mounting bars made. By the way, I had these made locally because I wanted the consistency all the time. And also, speed. I could change from one mounting bar to another in under a minute, which I'm sure would have been fun to. Fortunately, I don't have video of me making those changes, but that would have been entertaining for you, I'm sure. But I had all those bars made, went back to Schlesinger Hall, and tried all four of them, 60, 70, 80, and 90. Again, 60, too narrow a stage. 70, too narrow. 80, a little better, but too narrow. 90, comes close. But after extended listening, I figured, well, even that is too narrow a stage. This is important to get right. But not only the width of the stage, but it also has to interact with the rear microphones. They have to play nice with one another. And that was important. So I took the 90 degree 17 and the ORTF and went to the cathedral at the next session and tried only these. And once again, the 90 degree, a little narrow cathedral, the ORTF, a nice, full, big cathedral. So ORTF gets the stage width part very right. But now, there was the interesting part of it. And this is where the value of cathedral acoustics comes into play, because you get a nice long 5 seconds to notice what is happening with reverberation. Very useful. And I was lucky. I got nice, big, clean ringouts with both of these microphones and was able to compare them. The 9017 did not have localizable reverberation, which is just as live. You don't localize reverb. The ORTF localized reverb, and when the reverb dies, it dies between the loudspeakers. And that's unfortunate because that's another one of those tells that says this isn't real, this is a game, when you hear reverb dial like that. So the yellow dot represents the 100 degree bar. I did not have and still don't, but this is what I intend to try when I get back home. Or you can get slightly better numbers than that yellow dot represents by using 20 centimeter spacing and still keep the 90 degree angle. You get slightly better numbers. So the trick is to get as much of the stereo proportion in there as you can, but the stage width is the most important aspect of it. You have to get that right first. Mix down. I've done a lot of that in my life, but nothing that approaches this experience. It was a new experience for me, and it took quite a while to get used to it, and I think I'm still getting used to it, to learn how it works and how to work with it. The best way I can describe it is it's a process of retrieving reality. The important part is that you do have the ingredients for reality there. Now, you just have to find them and put them together properly. And you're just the guy to do it because you were there listening to the entire session live. Now it's appeared. You know what it is now to have that as your guide. And of course it also helps that it was your ears that placed the microphones to begin with. And you know that that's going to work out. How are we doing a little bit?
Well, 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. We will have to. The mix down is in the paper, so I don't think I have quite the time to go through that. And we arrive now at the sound clips. These two papers that we are giving here describe a monitoring situation very unlike, one might almost say the opposite of what we have here. And so there is going to be a lot of irony involved when we play these three sound clips over these existing loudspeakers, but it's the proper thing to do, and I guess so we're going to do it. The sound clips are roughly 1 minute each, and I have to start it here, did we agree on minus 30 dB on the faders there, I think? Let's see if it works. Schlesinger Hall, very small concert hall, 1,000 seats. And that was Ravel's The Spanish Hour that you heard. The next one is the orchestra in the National Cathedral playing Elgar's Sursum Corda. The applause you hear at the end is provided by chorus members who are waiting to take the stage. Thank you. signaling that the microphone was on during that?
I'm sorry, it seemed it was very bright. Yes. From here on the aisle, I was just curious if the light channel was reconfigured.
Oh. Thank you. I feel lucky that I can recognize the two from here. The last one is the choir and orchestra cathedral. It's from Paul Hindemith's Lilacs Requiem. Processes should be respected. They are just sitting there waiting for us to speak their language. And once we do, they can get right to work for you. It's free of charge. They're just sitting there. Accurate monitors are every bit as important in practice as theory suggests they should be. Every damn bit. For further experiments, I hope that I've been able to supply enough in the paper of the details so that it allows some of you to carry out your experiments certainly more efficiently than I've been able to. And if any of you would like a preview of what you're in for, I would suggest you find a musical group in rehearsal somewhere and walk back from them until you find a nice overall representative sound you think sounds good, and stand there and listen for a few minutes. And what you hear is what I've been describing in this paper. And if you're not impressed with what you hear there, there's a good possibility you've been listening to too many CDs and not enough live music. And finally, audio artifacts. This paper could have been subtitled Audio Artifacts Rule Our World. There are two main sources of audio artifacts. One is the loudspeakers and the room interaction. And the other is mic techniques. And only when the audio artifacts are removed from the monitors and the monitoring room interaction can the recording engineer intelligently, purposefully locate and remove or reduce the artifacts that he is responsible for. This is what monitor loudspeakers have been supposed to have been doing all along. It's their job. They should make no mistakes so that the engineer can hear what his mistakes are. It's the first time I came across this, and I thought you all ought to know about it. And this paper has been an example of the value of real monitors to a recording engineer. It's real. And I thank you very much for your time, and if there is any time, to answer that.
I'm talking about no time left anymore.
No time left.
I'm going to be one thing which I would like to mention is I had a very bad listening seat. And then, of course, I would have preferred to hear this via the loudspeakers of Siegfried Linkwitz. That would have been very different, and I think you agree. Okay, but unfortunately, there is no time left, and we have to go on to the next paper, which has the title. So, thank you very much, Don. Yes, thank you.